Excuse me, Senator Betzold. Please take the conversations outside. Please take the conversations outside. Excuse me. Please proceed, Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The attorney for the Mounds View School District read the statutes and applied that to a situation in the Mounds View School Board. They had a new board member that was elected last November, and the new member of the Mounds View School Board is married to an employee of the district, and they have their bargaining issues coming before the Mounds View School Board. It was quite clear that this particular board member would have a conflict of interest in voting on the employment contract because she is married to a employee of the district. However, the interpretation that the school board's attorney came in reading the conflict of interest statutes that not only would she have a conflict of interest, but every school board member would have a conflict of interest as long as she remains on the board. That's not an interpretation I have, and as far as I know, that is not one that other school districts have had. However, since this issue has now been raised, it has caused other school districts to now take a closer look at the issue, and they want to err on the side of caution and not wind up having a school board that where none of the members can vote, and in fact, if they do, they could be liable for criminal charges if any of them participate. As I say, this is a rather unusual situation. The school board's attorney has requested an opinion from the Attorney General's office to clarify that section regarding conflict of interest for school board members. However, that was just done fairly recently, and whether or not it can be done while the legislature is in session is questionable. So Senate File 2653 comes before you as language that hopefully addresses that question. Now, there's a one-word A1 amendment that I'd like to have offered.
Okay. Senator Rummel moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, indicate aye. Opposed? Carried.
And Mr. Chair, members, basically, just to clarify what the A1 amendment is that you may have maybe a couple of school board members that might have a conflict of interest, and then that would preclude the school board from actually acting on anything. This says a majority of disinterested school board members. So even if more than one has a conflict of interest, you could still proceed with whatever is left as long as a majority feel the appropriate wish to do so. One other issue that has come up, and I don't quite have it here, and I don't know if council's had a chance to look at it and consider it. Apparently there's been some desire to not put this in subdivision 5, because, and you know, I think there's some interest in just having it, you know, on its own. But this is a question of just where it's placed in the statutes, and I don't really have any thoughts on that particular issue. But I don't know if council is here or not.
Ms. Junker, did you want to offer an opinion on placement?
Mr. Chair, members, I have no opinion at this moment. I just pulled it out, so wasn't aware of someone addressing an issue about that.
It's something that's just been quite very, very recently brought to my attention. I don't think there may be some people here who want to. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill, Mr. Chair and members. There's some certain people in support of it, and they can talk about the placement issue.
Yes. Welcome, Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We are supporting Senator Betzel's 2653 on conflict of interest. This is a key important issue for my board members. You will find oftentimes in families that are involved in education, you have more than a spouse or a partner who is involved in the school district in some way, whether it's driving the bus or helping out in the lunch line. And this truly clarifies the law as we saw it, as it fits forward. The sub 5 division really came at the request of the cities and counties and townships. It's a piece of law they use to do business on, and there's a lot of case law on it, so they were very reluctant to see that changed. And so they suggested instead a separate subdivision to deal with this issue, hence why we got to subdivision 21, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. Senator Betzold, did you have any other testifiers?
I don't.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to address the committee? Further discussion, Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Betzel, I think this is an excellent bill. Having served on a school board and as a county commissioner, there are a number of folks who might have a spouse as a teacher on a school board, or a county commissioner may have a spouse that is an employee of the county. So I applaud your work on this. I guess it kind of surprises me that we have to go to the level of making it a law, you know, that somebody would have to abstain to. Unfortunately, that to me should be common knowledge that there's an interest there that they should be abstaining.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I agree with that. I think that the issue can be remedied quite easily with an abstention, but again, that's not the the opinion that came forward by the attorney for the school board, and he felt that just if this school board member just recused herself and abstained, that would not in itself solve the problem, because the way he's reading this the statute, it says it applies to every elected member. The word "every," I think, was what's throwing him. That's the word that's in statute, and I think it's been there since 1951, or every public official who violates this. So what they thought of in 1951 may be different from how we read it today, but that's how he's reading it today.
Senator Saltzman.
I guess I have a question, Senator Betzel. On line 115 directs the school board member's spouse to abstain from voting. That would mean that the spouse would not be able to vote on the contract. Is that correct?
Senator Betzel.
School board member, yes, because they
right. So does Education Minnesota, have they signed off on this? Is there a concern at all that their member would not be allowed to vote? I just want to just ask that question in advance.
Sure, Senator Salzman, I have not heard from Education Minnesota's position on this one. I don't know if they have a position on this, but again, this is a conflict of interest issue. It shouldn't matter. If you have a conflict, you shouldn't be voting, but it shouldn't apply to anybody beyond the person with the conflict. So I think that, you know, I hope the language that we have here addresses that situation.
Okay. I just want to note that we've not heard any concerns about that.
Further discussion? Not. Senator Romo moves that Senate File 2653 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Further discussion? Not. All in favor indicate aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Betzel.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2754 is a bill that deals with background checks, and you've dealt with this, I believe, this year already as a Senate Judiciary Committee, which also wants to see this bill if it passes from this committee. Obviously, we're more sensitive, want more background checks, but there has been more of a trend to having a school hiring authority actually contracting with somebody else to actually do the background checks and receive the background checks, which may make some sense, but we do have some principles already in the Data Practices Act that says that if you contract it out, they are still bound by the terms of the law. They if they receive sensitive data, they can't share it, just as if they were the government entity. Now, we do have an A1 amendment that's quite a technical amendment, just to put the bill in the shape that I wish to proceed as the chief author. Mr. Chair, if somebody could move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Senator Johnson moves the A1 amendment, which is being distributed. All in favor, indicate aye. Opposed? Carry.
Does Dosslyn here? She, I believe Valerie does. Somebody here?
Mr. Kay.
Mr. Neumeister has some concerns about the bill, so.
Make sure we have the A1 out.
Senator Wieger and members of the committee, I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I'm just here to introduce the two testifiers we have on this bill. Annie Doty is the Executive Director of Human Resource Services for the Wayzata Public Schools, and Keith Gray is the Director of Human Resources for the North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale School District. As you know, the state does require all school districts to do a BCA check on every prospective employee. Many of our school districts are also going beyond that and doing an additional security check. What we are asking in this bill is that that those two processes simply could be combined. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Ms. Doty.
Welcome, Ms. Doty.
Thank you, Chairman and Senators. My name is Annie Doty. I'm with the Wayzata Public Schools. We have about almost 10,000 students in our school district, and our main objective with this is to keep our kids safe. And we've always done the background checks through the BCA since we were mandated to. But several years ago, became aware that there were some limitations with the BCA check. And we contracted with an outside company. And we get very detailed information. They can do it through an address check. And we also get it very timely. We have it within 24 hours. We've worked with the BCA. Julie Letourneau-Lackner has been very helpful. So she's helped us with the language and to meet both our needs because she understands that we would just like to meld the two processes. And I think that's all I was going to say for now.
Thank you. Mr. Gray?
Hi, I'm Keith Gray. Sorry for the low-voiced today. I'll give it my best shot here today. North St. Paul has about 11,000 students, and like Annie is stating, our primary concern is to make sure that people who come and work at our school district and work with our children are people of high quality and that there are no problems in their background check. We started doing a deeper background check several years ago. When we had some additional information surface. So we do probably in excess of 600 background checks per year. That's doing background checks on anybody who works in our school district, coaches, janitors, any of those individuals that work at the school district. Like I said, our primary concern is to make sure that there's a thorough and complete background check. We are sometimes even doing out-of-state background checks for those people who have recently moved to Minnesota. So we, too, would like to be able to meld these two processes together. The sooner we can do that, the quicker we can also get the background checks together, and then also we can hire people and put people in critical positions in our school district. As you know, every time we don't have somebody in a classroom or in a position, that somebody else is having to do it. And again, that compromises student safety. I think that's all I have to add.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And both Senator Olson and I represent the Wayzata School District. So, Annie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And I, too, support the bill and have talked to the people at Wayzata and understand that you do perform your due diligence and that it is not in any way undermining that. So just wanted to speak in support.
Thank you. Further questions of the testifiers? Mr. Neumeister. And thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. More than likely, I know that this will go to another committee.
But yes, it would go to
judiciary. I think these are some important things that you need to know about. First of all, this is one of the first times that we're putting in state statute the allowance of where third parties will be able to get access directly of BCA data. Before, this has never been the case, and it's because of some changes in federal law. So what basically is going to happen, a school district is going to be getting BCA data, and then secondly, the third party will be able to get all the other kinds of data that they can't get. Let's say like civil data, bankruptcy data, credit reporting, all they can get it from other kinds of, you know, all the other stuff that's out there about individuals. And a lot of these companies will be background check companies. And all what this bill allows is them to get more access, more of a direct access and more together of BCA records. So you're, as it was described, they're melding of all that data. And then the individual, which is thousands and thousands of people, whether it be volunteers or employees in school districts, there's going to be something about them. But who's going to have it is not necessarily the government, but it's going to be that third party. And one of the things that I believe that this bill can go a little bit further on is to improve as to what those standards are going to be. Now, the law, the federal law, and the BCA, which is going to be coming under standards, is that there's going to have to be auditing, there's going to have to be retention schedules, there's going to be a number of kinds of things that are going to be done. My question is, are the local school districts going to do that audit, those security things, those retention schedules, which costs money, and all those kinds of things like that? Now, the BCA, the BCA under this new contract and these 30 third-party contracts, the BCA is going to say, oh, it's up to the local school district. It's not necessarily that the BCA is going to enforce those kinds of things with audits and all that. So there's that issue there of lots of data about thousands of Minnesotans in a third party. And there are some standards there, but the issue is who is going to really be the enforcer of those standards. The second aspect, which I think is so much more important than that, is that you're going to be having now for the first time the melding of these two pots of information. Again, being served on prospective employees who get checks and other kinds of folks. Throughout the school districts, there are different standards of how this information gets to people. Sometimes it's just a verbal sort of thing. Hey, Mr. Neumeister, your report came back and, we're not going to do this or do that. Sometimes you may not even get a copy, maybe talk to you or whatever. There's standards all over the board. So what I'm suggesting, as this bill goes forward, to try and set up some standards for this background check if it's going to be done by third parties. It will tell the individual what the purpose is, your right to be informed, you have a right to get a copy, you get a right to find out the record that forms that data is about, because there is some information that supports that data, that you have the right to challenge the accuracy and completeness of it. And you also need to be told specifically why you're denied, that either that volunteer position, that employment, or whatever. Because the standards are all over the board, and I'm suggesting, as this bill goes forward, those standards be in place, like what you already have in other background checks, like with the children's background check and other ones. There are specific standards for that. I think that should be the case in this situation. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments and points. And if there are any questions.
Questions of Mr. Neumeister.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Betzelt. Does your bill require disclosure to the person that's having the background check?
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, the bill itself I don't believe does, but I don't have the whole section of statute before me that deals with school background checks. I don't know if that's covered in the whole section or not.
Mr. Chair, my name is Valerie Dozlin. I'm the lobbyist with the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And Minnesota Statute 123B03, which requires the background check, says that the individual who is the subject of the background check has to execute a written consent form giving the school hiring authority the access to the results of the background check. So they have to be aware before the check is done.
Do they get a copy of it when it comes
out? I don't know the answer to that question. I can find that out.
Senator Johnson. Mr. Neumeister.
It's not clear to me, yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, whether they do get a copy under current law right now.
Okay. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, that's basically the law. I mean, they get consent, but down the line, they may not get a copy, they may not get the rationale, and that's why fair information practices have like five seeds to it. One of them is at least you get the consent. Now, on that consent form, some may tell some of their rights, some may not. There's not a standard form. It varies all across the board. I'm just trying to make sure that young people are safe, but also individuals get a fair shake at things, too.
Thank you. Further questions, Mr. Neumeister? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We support this bill and this initiative.
Closer to the mic, please. Thank you.
We support this bill and this initiative. We feel it is key to keeping kids safe. It gives us the ability to go back to the counties where the individuals lived and find information there that may not be picked up in the BCA check. So I think it's an integral part. Any information we keep on an individual in the school district is always available to the individual, period. So they do have access to that information.
Questions? Okay. And members, as you know, this is the third bill before us on the issue of safer schools as it relates to background checks. We had Senator Saltzman's proposal for teachers, Senator Rest addressing coaches, others, and bottom line is to address safe schools. The points will be further addressed in the Judiciary Committee, and I'll entertain a motion at this point. If Senator Bonhoff and Olson move that Senate File 2754 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Judiciary Committee, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson and I are trying to figure some things out here. And I think we both have a real strong history of being school advocates and that sort of thing, but I'm wondering if we could just understand a little bit more about the third-party piece that Mr. Neumeister talked about, because while we want schools to have access to the information that they need, we're also very strong proponents of, you know, private protections. And Senator Betzold, I'm wondering what you think about that, because I know you're a strong advocate for individuals. And then we're also wondering if that third party needs to be bonded.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, the A1 amendment on page 1, line 8, inserted the language, you know, shall comply with section 13.05, subdivision 11. That is part of the Data Practices Act. And that's something that we recognized a few years ago, that there were more instances of privatization where government data that is sensitive, you know, non-public, was going to be privatized, and it was going to go into the hands of entities that were not government agencies. We have some very strict provisions in the Data Practices Act for those government agencies that disclose non-public data. For example, if the Department of Revenue were to disclose your tax returns or my tax returns, that's private data. They can't do that. There's penalties for doing that. But what happens if you have some privatization, some entity outside of government that is receiving the data? This may be unusual for school boards to get BCA data, but this is not unprecedented in the government. And so that's why we added this section 1305, subdivision 11, to say that if that is done, the contract must specify that this private entity is going to be bound by all the provisions and the penalties in particular of the Data Practices Act. So we already recognize that it's possible to have private entities, and that the Act itself will apply to them because the contract must specify that.
Okay. Senator Erickson-Ropes. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzold, does that mean that there is a destruction also? I'm not familiar with that part of the Data Practices Act, but when a private company gets in possession of this information and then passes it on to a school board or a school administrator, do they need to destroy their copy of it?
Sir Betzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I don't know that it's the law specifies that a retention schedule that certainly could be done by contract, but the law is quite specific that if you get non-public data, you must maintain the classification of that data. If it's non-public, you cannot disclose it except to those people who have a need to get that information. So, but I don't know if it says anything about a retention schedule. I don't recall the words of the statute right now, but that, as I say, that could be done by contract.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Betzold, then, is there, what happens if, and this happened to me, and this was within the government system, but as a veteran, I had my Social Security number and all of that sort of stuff a few years ago, walk out the door with a couple million other veterans on a computer that was stolen. What sort of liability does this third party have then for information that winds up in a public venue?
Chairman Petzl?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ropes, my Social Security number was also in that laptop that was stolen, too. But that was a federal government issue and so forth, so the Minnesota Data Practices Act would not have applied to that. I don't have the list of penalties sitting in front of me, so I don't want to, you know, comment on it. But there are. Let me just say that the penalties are there. I just don't have the act in front of me to say what the wrongful disclosure involves.
All right. Thank you.
Further questions? We have Senate File 2754 as amended, recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We will go next to Senate File 3151, Senator Torres-Ray. It's our intent to vote about 40 to 45 minutes on that, and then we'll go to Senator Rummel, Senate File 3250, which would hopefully take us to about 5 o'clock if we're ready to vote. There's a caucus for each party at 5 o'clock. It's our intent to meet following the last caucus to adjourn. So probably at 6 o'clock we'll continue, and not for too long, but to at least talk about some of the issues in the department's policy and technical bill. And I recognize there's other meetings going on this evening, but that will be necessary depending on the amount of time that we have now. It's not our intent to take any action on the department's bill, but we may consider some amendments on some areas that have been discussed and fully shared, but no final action will be taken on that if you're not here.
Mr. Chair? Yeah, I just have a question.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
I'm trying to think of all these juggled schedules here. I think we have a continuation of health care committee meeting at 6 o'clock as well.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. They'll be in here, and we'll be in room 112.
So how are we going to do that? Those of us who are on both committees, Senator Johnson and Senator Lynch.
I believe it's not our intent to take any action, and as you know, that happens frequently where we'll have to have two committees that are meeting, but it's not our intent to take any action on that bill. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's really a pleasure for me to be able to report about the work that we conducted during the summer and during the fall on Achievement Gap, and put together some recommendations that have been strongly supported by several people in the community, particularly by superintendents and other scholars who have done extensive research related to Achievement Gap. We had a committee, as you know, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee who were working with us. I co-chair an Achievement Gap committee with Senator Erickson-Ropes, and we worked diligently to put together an agenda that became quite complicated as we found out that many people in the community, not just in Minnesota but outside of Minnesota, had some great ideas and wanted to contribute to this process and wanted to be part of it. Through that process, we were able to compile some information and really learn great things. But what became very clear to us, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that this is a very complex issue and that we have been talking about it for a number of years in Minnesota and in the nation. Many school districts and many communities have been talking about different strategies, different alternatives that they have contemplated and adopted to address Achievement Gap in their school districts and in their states. We found out that a number of districts in the state of Minnesota are already moving forward with specific plans to address achievement gaps within their populations, and that it is difficult to really say today that those specific strategies are strategies that could be replicated because we have not really had the time to implement those strategies over a period of time where we can conduct evaluation and really look at the impact that those particular practices have had. I would like to clarify before I move forward that in the version that you have right now, you have authors. I hope that you have the most current version, and I've neglected
yes,
to
Senator
say Torres, that I
we,
need
we
to
have the delete all A4 amendment,
correct.
And if you'd like to move that A4, then we'll have the bill in the form that you would like. So Senator
like Torres-Rae
moves the author's A4 amendment. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, carried.
Thank you.
A4.
So now I would like to go briefly explain what are the elements of this particular proposal, and then I would like to invite some people to testify. We have a number of people who are going to offer some testimony really related to different experiences, but very particularly I have invited some superintendents who are currently working on this issue who will be here speaking about their experience and their views on this particular proposal, and I have also invited the University of Minnesota, which is an institution that has been very involved in this process. The Children, Youth, and Family Consortium in particular has been very instrumental in helping me convene a series of meetings to bring stakeholders to provide testimony and provide their expertise. The bill that you have in front of you basically has four important components. The first one is a requirement to school districts that are experiencing disparities, a task of developing a plan to significantly improve a student's academic achievement using concrete measures to eliminate differences in academic performance. So this is an invitation to those districts that have come to us to really express concerns about this issue. And what we are asking them to do is to submit a plan to us. The second part of this legislation provides a framework that will help those particular districts really look at some best practices that are now available to them to really frame and put together those proposals. We have included some dates for the process of developing and submitting the plans. These dates were dates that were we provide in here, and we consulted with the commissioner. We wanted to make sure that school districts will have an opportunity to work on these plans at the same time that they are working on other reports so that they can build on the current work that they are doing. The third part of this legislation asks the state of Minnesota to convene an advisory task force that will be working with the Commissioner of Education and with the districts and the different committees on education to really look at different components of excellence in education, and they are named in page 2 from 1 to 6, and this was really work that was conducted by the University of Minnesota, compiling a lot of information that came from different reports, again, to provide a framework. And this work will be examined by the committees on education and the commissioner, and they will constitute what we will call the state plan on achievement gap. And the hope is that we will be able to come back in 2009 to really put together a practical plan for the state of Minnesota that will be consistent and will build on strategies and ideas that have been presented by the different districts and by people who have conducted research in this area. So those are the four elements of this proposal. And with me, I have Ms. Audrey, and I can never pronounce your last name
Appleseas.
Correct. Appleseas, who has been really working very diligently, again, to put together information and compile some of the information that we heard during the hearings. We had four hearings and invited different people from different backgrounds to provide information on issues related to achievement gap. Okay. So,
thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Education Committee. It is an honor to be here today. I'm Dr. Audrey Appelsees from the University of Minnesota at the Children, Youth, and Family Consortium. And the purpose of the consortium is to increase capacity of the University of Minnesota and Minnesota's communities to use research, inform policy, and enhance practice to improve the well-being of children and families in the state. We are interested in being responsive to all legislators. And one of the things that I'm currently working on is a request from Senator Torres Rey, the co-chair of the Achievement Gap Subcommittee, to gather and organize research related to this bill. I will briefly, for you this afternoon, frame the way that this bill has come to be and give a summary of the consultative process that has gone into its development. And first, what do we mean by educational disparities? Theoretically, we believe that Minnesota's K-12 public education students participate in the same system, yet when compared by race, ethnicity, and family income levels, it is clear that there are persisting differences in the educational opportunities and outcomes of children of color and children living in poverty and their white and or middle class counterparts. The key here is that research demonstrates that disparities exist in both opportunities and outcomes. Importantly, Ferguson notes, quote, achievement gaps are not facts of nature, and to his point, from a systems level, we can make a difference. Some might wonder why we talk about race and ethnicity and language and culture. Isn't this just about poverty? And this is a complicated point, but there are studies that show, and you have some of that data in front of you, I think, that when controlled for income levels, students of color still underperform on standardized measures. It is incumbent upon educational systems to make a change, and this bill will begin to address how the state of Minnesota can take leadership in ending disparities. How will we as a state create a world-class system for all students? The primary purpose of this legislation is to improve district structures and educational programs and practices for all students and to reduce educational disparities. This proposed statewide form is unique. No other state is creating and addressing systemic change from this particular perspective. This bill, as Senator Torres Rey covered, asks that districts submit a plan, and then we go through a year process of review by a diverse task force of stakeholders guided by research on pedagogy, school reform, and teacher development, which will inform a statewide plan for the following year. Next is an overview of the consultative process taken by the Subcommittee on the Achievement Gap. There were four hearings. As Senator Torres Rey mentioned, we heard from a range of stakeholders, superintendents, university researchers, the councils of color, and consultants. We met with MDE multiple times to review state data, and we convened a generative meeting of legislators and state superintendents to discuss this proposal. What issues concern communities of color? There are four challenges identified through these tests. Through their testimony, there's an overall agreement that there are significant rates of educational disparities throughout the system in Minnesota. Challenge two, all stakeholders must raise expectations and increase opportunities for students of color, and schools must become more culturally relevant. For example, providing translators for families whose first language is not English, recruiting and training more teachers of color. And fourth, the state must improve data collection and dissemination of data and increase our sampling. You will hear from superintendents this afternoon also, but I will briefly say that superintendents and school districts face rapidly changing demographics, districts face funding cuts, and districts want improved MDE reporting systems. They want increased meaningfulness and efficacy of those systems. Throughout this process, too, we have met with MDE and will continue to do so as we create new systems. Dr. Samuel Myers from the University of Minnesota testified about the achievement gap rates in Minnesota. And just to give you a brief sense of what we're looking at here, for example, NAEP data shows that fourth grade readers, the discrepancy between scores between African American and white students is 16.7%. In grade 8, the gap for black and white students is 11.4%. There are persisting gaps across all measures for between students of color and their white counterparts. Our graduation rates, 93% of white non-Hispanic students are graduating from Minnesota high schools, while 55% of Hispanic students are graduating from our high schools. To paraphrase state economist Tom Stinson, in the future, our population will become more diverse. And if our overall graduation rates don't keep pace, we will have a declining impact on the quality and size of our workforce in the future. Finally, Minnesota mirrors the national trends. We have persisting and prevalent gaps in opportunity and access and achievement. In conclusion, we have some of the highest rates of achievement. We have a world-class system for white middle-class students in this state. But we can improve the future of Minnesota's economic outlook as well as the quality of life and well-being for all of Minnesota's children by providing leadership in terms of ending educational disparities. Thank you. And Chairman Wieger, I'm glad to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you for the excellent summary and all of the work that you provided during the interim. Questions? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I now would like to invite four superintendents that have come to testify on behalf in support of this legislation. I have superintendent from St. Paul, Rochester, Osseo School District. I think that's all I have.
Welcome. We have some additional handouts, but we'll let you proceed in the order that you have agreed to.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Maria Karstarfen. I'm the superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools. Senator Torres Rey asked me to come here today to talk to you about our district. Our achievement gaps and what we're actually doing to address the achievement gaps. Our district serves a diverse population reflecting more than 70 languages and dialects. Daily, more than 40,000 students arrive in our 66 schools with an array of educational experiences and skills. Some are reading and doing math before they enter kindergarten, whereas others have never held a pencil, waited in line, or had the fortune of having books at home. Regardless of a student's preparation in school, our job is to raise expectations and educate all students for success. We know from experience that when we raise expectations, kids actually live up to them. Similarly, if we have low expectations, students will often meet those too, as will adults. Our job is to educate all and to expect the most of them and from them. St. Paul Public Schools is on a mission and is gaining momentum to close the achievement gap for all students while raising the bar on learning for all. And I really want to emphasize that because I hope that in the conversation about the achievement gap, we don't get so focused on one area of our work that we undermine ourselves in other areas. It would be a shame to see in even our metro centers that this focus would then run much of our middle class out of school systems. So it's a very delicate balance in talking about the achievement gap, delivering on programs that work and incentives that work and a focus that works while also serving the needs of all other students. We have a very diverse student population. We also believe that in our district that we cannot close the gap on our own. And there's much research to show that no matter how hard a district will work, you will not significantly close the gap if you don't have all of your other partners and resources in place. 35 years ago, we benefited from the results of a great turning point in Minnesota history known as the Minnesota Miracle of 1971, which eliminated fiscal disparities between school districts. We believe, as you know, that that investment paid off. In the 1960s, less than half of Minnesotans over the age of 20 had a high school degree, and now we lead the nation at 91%. However, in the past decade, Minnesota's national reputation as an educational leader has taken some hits. You may have seen in a recent article in the Star Tribune, I do believe. It was the Star Tribune on February 10th, that the CEOs of the Minneapolis Foundation, St. Paul Foundation, Bush Foundation, and McKnight Foundation came together to talk about their view of the state on the opinion page. Kate Wolford, the president of the McKnight Foundation, said that the Minnesota miracle is moving toward Minnesota mediocrity. Between 1995 and 2000, Minnesota's national ranking on per-pupil spending dropped from 4th to 24th. The result? Education Week's 2008 Quality Count Survey reports that Minnesota gets a C for overall school performance and support. Minnesota ranks 22nd nationally in school finance equity and spending. Minnesota ranks 39th nationally in its efforts to improve teaching. Education Weekly recently gave Minnesota a D in investment in teacher quality. And USA Today reported Minnesota is one of only 24 states that have outdated attendance laws that hinder anti-dropout efforts, such as leaving the dropout age at 16 rather than raising it to 18. Reflections on trends from the state showed in this opinion article that more than 152,000 children live in poverty, up 35% from 2000. Race and class issues are not honestly being addressed, and there's a growing disparity between the haves and have-nots. Over the last 10 years, the absolute number of high school graduates will decline. While enrollment statewide continues to decline, the number of those least likely to graduate is actually growing. So in a nutshell, all four of them agree that Minnesota has worked long and hard on its social capital. But emerging trends indicate that our carefully built infrastructure, especially around education, is eroding. Now, all this, while Minnesota's estimated deficit is projected to be approximately $1 billion, we in education are concerned about what the future education investments may look like, if not anything at all. We cannot allow this reversal to continue. Minnesota will not be able to attract and maintain its global market share, and we won't be able to retain and attract major employers when the quality of our education system is at question. And as you saw in the presentation earlier, when you look at poverty and race, it gets extremely complicated. The president of the Minneapolis Foundation said, "We can't afford not to think about the long term. If we don't plant the seeds now with good education and health care for all kids and families, we are about to drop significantly in our competitiveness with other communities." Now, why am I telling you, people at the state who know all the state data probably better than I, and sharing with you some of our partners that we work with on a daily basis and fund our efforts to close the achievement gap? We think that it would be absolutely unrealistic at any time to continue to put mandates on school districts without following it with funding. So I caution us now, even in the upcoming school year, that we must find a way to provide an inflationary increase to get us through the next year, and as we think about this legislation and moving forward, to ensure that the dollars to do the gap-closing work go to school systems. With all that said, I am very happy to still testify today about achievement gaps and to support the idea that our state and school districts have to very intentionally address closing the achievement gaps. In St. Paul, our white students are more than twice as likely to be proficient as black students and American Indian students. Our gaps are as large in this area around reading and math in about the 41 percentage point range. In reading, white students are more than twice as likely to be as proficient as black students. Black students score 40 percentage points below white students. And I could keep going down the ethnic groups. Reading and writing, low income, this is poverty. Students in poverty are twice as likely to be proficient. Non-low-income students who are not in poverty, are twice as likely to be proficient as low-income students in reading and math. And non-special ed students, that means regular ed kids, are more than twice as likely to be proficient as special ed students. We know that when we disaggregated our data even further, that the outlook for African-American students and Latino students in particular was extraordinarily bleak. In spite of our efforts to reduce the dropout rates, we have a disparity with our graduation rates. Only 51% of American Indian students, 60% of Latino students, and 74% of black students graduated from St. Paul Public Schools in 2006. What we do believe would make a difference for us, and what we did act on, was to address our issues with a lot of community collaboration, but more importantly, sort of mapping out for ourselves what kind of plan would we need to actually get at these issues that are often uncomfortable and sometimes are showstoppers, depending on the health of your own internal school community. We have a 5-year comprehensive strategic plan, which is the backbone of our work, and it was developed extensively with our community. We have clear vision, mission, goals, strategies, targets, benchmarks, measurable outcomes, an implementation guide with a timeline. But Douglas Reeves, who's another researcher in accountability, would tell you that a plan is just a plan if you aren't constantly monitoring it. What we think makes our plan the real deal is that we stand up in front of our community every year doing an annual report that monitors and is transparent about whether or not we hit all those targets, benchmarks, and measurable outcomes. We believe that at the heart of the achievement gap is what we've been discussing internally as the soft bigotry of low expectations. Although they are hard, we're beginning to have courageous conversations about race and poverty and how they actually intersect with the quality of a child's education. In the United States, only a few more than half of African American and Latino students actually graduate on time. And a recent study from Stanford University showed that only 12 to 14% of those graduates can actually meet the requirements of a state university. In our district, and as the federal government will even tell you under No Child Left Behind, tracking graduation rates is one of the best ways to see whether or not a community is actually doing the job that it's expected to do, because you need to expect kids to graduate. We know that there are other areas that need to be addressed: suspensions, referrals to special education, particularly EBD, are of serious concern to us. And at the end of it all, we believe that by investing in our referendum, having it pass — I know that all of our colleagues across the state haven't had that — investing in staff development, job-embedded coaching, using data and best practices and community involvement to guide our work, were critical. We would encourage the state to continue to invest in teacher development, to fund early childhood education and all-day kindergarten programs, to extend the school day year by restoring extended time revenue from 0.2 to 0.5, to support our high school initiatives, and to increase the school attendance age from 16 to 18. We'd also like to see flexibility in our ability to do more innovative programming. And, of course, as we started with the beginning of the testimony, having reliable, stable funding is critical. I'll close by saying that one of the things our district has done is started to partner with national organizations. And we've asked the Alliance for Excellence in Education to analyze from a fiscal standpoint the cost of losing kids in high school. And I will summarize in four bullet points. The cost of dropouts in Minnesota looks like the following. Each year, nearly 14,900 students in Minnesota do not graduate with their peers. Dropouts from the class of 2007 cost the state almost $3.9 billion in lost wages, taxes, and productivity over their lifetime. Two, if Minnesota's likely dropouts from the class of 2006 had graduated instead, the state could save more than $224 million in Medicaid and expenditures for uninsured care over the course of that young person's life. Third, if Minnesota's high schools and colleges raise the graduation rates of Hispanics, African Americans, and Native American students to the levels of white students by 2020, I know you're going to be talking to Minnesota Promise, and I asked them to look at this specifically, the potential increase in personal income would add more than $1.3 billion to the state economy. And finally, increasing the graduation rate and college matriculation of male students in Minnesota by only 5% could lead to the combined savings and revenues of almost $77.7 million each year by reducing crime-related costs. So here in St. Paul, we're here to support the idea of having our districts focus more on closing the achievement gap, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman?
Yes. Just a few questions, and I just want to thank you, Superintendent, because your name always comes up for your commitment, your passion, and your tireless energy on this issue, so thank you. And I am a former St. Paul School District parent and served on district-wide advisory councils. And I looked at the task force that is recommended here. And I guess I want to ask you that when we look at the achievement gap, is it their problem or our problem in how we're going to address the achievement gap? Is it this? Is it everybody in this room? Is it our responsibility to address this, or is it somebody else's? That's not a trick question.
I mean, I think it's fair to say, as I went on, you know, in my testimony, saying that, you know, no district can do this alone. I mean, I know good leaders in districts with good staff and great kids that without the resources, because they can't pass their referendum, they need their public to support them while we go through this challenging funding cycle as the state has been experiencing in recent years. And I think that everyone has a role in it. I think at the end of the day, however, as far as teaching and delivering high-quality instruction, that should take place in schools, and our community should hold us accountable. But at the same time, it's just this catch-22 that we do, where if you're not funding what you say you expect people to do, and you're constantly hog-tying them and being able to have the ability to do this work, I don't think anybody gets anywhere. But I do think legislators, parents, you know, business people, teachers, our kids even, have responsibility in closing the gap. What we've talked about in our district is a shared accountability model, which we'd be happy to, you know, give you for the record, where we go through each one of those stakeholder groups and say, you know, I can teach them, but you got to get them on the bus on time, mom, dad, caregiver, you got to get them on the bus, and we'll take it from there. You know, but it's even some of the more basic things, given some of our student and family challenges, are very complicated for people to do. So we just need to have the conversation and have people know what we expect of them.
Right. So just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I guess when I look at this plan, I look at the task force members and I see it as it's somebody else's problem, because the people who have been selected as members of this committee very specifically talk to communities of color, but we all have to address this. And unless we look at this as our issue as a state, that it should not be. I think that I have made comments, and as a white suburban legislator, I have heard back that I don't understand, I'm not involved. At times it's not my problem, and that I should be listening to this community or that, and yet we are all responsible. So I guess I would encourage that in looking at this task force, that we look at this as including everyone, because if we don't, we're not going to get the resources. We're not going to get the money. Another suggestion, you talked about the achievement gap and making sure that no one sees this as that we just want to raise the bar for some kids, for all kids. I have a lot of parents from the gifted and talented community who I work with, and I'm saying to them, we need to look at all kids. And so I would also suggest that if we're going to identify looking at the achievement gap as looking at bringing kids who are struggling up, we also need to assure every parent that we're trying to raise all kids up. So to look at this in a more inclusive way, because one of the reasons that I felt that I chose to leave St. Paul was because I felt at some point that my interests were not important. And I think that that's very important that we look at this as our state's issue, and that I just want to send a message that the achievement gap is not about one community addressing it. It needs to be all of us.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Salzman, I really appreciate your comment because I can't tell you how much I appreciate that message. I agree with you 100%. It's really the responsibility of the state of Minnesota, of all of us. This issue around who needs to be part of it was something that we talk about again and again, and this is precisely why we really incorporated all of these elements into this proposal. One is that we wanted to work, of course, with the practitioners, with the different districts, because they already, as you heard from the superintendent, they're already working on this. They already have spent a number of times contracted with experts working with our own communities. We want to build on that. We also heard that we have a mandate from the federal government with No Child Left Behind. So we can't just say, well, now we have a different mandate. No, we have to build on that progress we've made. Mm-hmm. And this task force is really a recommendation that came from multiple sources because they agree exactly with your concept that all of us need to be part of it. And this became a very complicated issue because as we tried to figure out who needed to be part of the task force, it became pages and pages. So what we decided to do to address that concern, on page 4, you will notice that on page line 4, it says that the task force members at their discretion may invite other representatives. Because, many people thought we don't have, for instance, I didn't have in here the business sector. Mm-hmm. But I had a hard time figuring out who's going to appoint somebody from the business sector. I couldn't. So if the task force members want to invite a representative, some people mentioned the Itasca group, for instance, and other groups that have worked on this issue in the past. So we put that language in there to open this process and to extend an invitation to the different stakeholders that really need to be part of the conversation because they do have the expertise.
Thank you.
I know that we're running out of time, so, Mr. Chair, I believe you have a question.
Sir Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the author, I'll keep it brief. I know we want to get to the other testifiers. I guess one of my biases on this topic starts with, and I think was actually affirmed by Dr. Karstarfen, is that districts, superintendents, school boards are already diving into this problem and coming up with plans. And so my question to Senator Torres-Rae, specifically to your bill, to the A4, your bill requires a plan. St. Paul has a plan, right? Is it your thought that, in essence, this bill wouldn't require anything more of St. Paul because they're already doing it, but there are some other school districts who are not? Or perhaps this would be a model for them?
Senator Dorsey.
Mr. Chair and Senator Mitchell, exactly. The intent here is to really create some consistency and build a plan for the state of Minnesota that will be based on these wonderful models that we already have. The reason we are moving forward with this proposal is because St. Paul and the superintendents that you see here are not the rule, they are the exception. And the reason other districts are not moving forward is because they either don't have the resources or the problem is not as significant, perhaps, as it is in some of the larger districts, but they are moving in that direction. So what I am hoping to do is that we are offering this opportunity for all the superintendents and for all the districts to come together to really formulate a plan that could serve as the foundation for the plan for the state of Minnesota. And this plan should not be prescriptive, but it should have some framework, because part of what is happening right now is that the superintendents, and you may hear that from the testimony, are working in isolation. St. Paul is working and doing significant work within their own community. Minneapolis is doing the same. Rochester, Osseo, all of the districts right now that really are facing these challenges right now are working, but we would like to offer an opportunity to bring them together and more particularly to support their efforts as a state, because as Senator Salzman stated, this is a problem that many districts are facing and that we have a responsibility to address as a whole.
Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair and Superintendent Karstafen, I liked what you said. And one of the problems I have is that I don't write fast enough. And I would like you to go through your last 4 points there, the cost of dropouts again, because what I see is that we're not talking about kids here. We're not talking about children anymore. We're really talking about our future workforce. And this is the impact that this is exactly where the impact is how much it costs us and how much remedial work it costs us and how much we could save by investing and getting the dropouts to finish school. And this is only dropouts. It's not getting them further in education. So could you repeat those last 4 points for me again?
Could we make
Senator Carlson, and maybe a brief highlight. Sure. It's very expensive dropouts, and there's a lot of documentation, but perhaps reinforce that, and we'll ask. We have several others that want to testify, and we'll do our best to then look at the specific language in the bill. But Superintendent?
Yes, Chair, Senator Carlson. The most important thing about the dropouts that I just want to emphasize is that they are mostly kids of color. They're poor, and they're kids of color. So if we educate them, they will cost the state less and actually have a higher quality life. But at the same time, they're a significant cost to the communities and states if you don't address it. The cost to the state from the dropouts of 2007 was $3.9 billion in lost wages, taxes, and productivity. The second point was, if the class of 2006 had graduated instead, those who dropped out, you could have saved $224 million in Medicaid and other uninsured care. The third point was, when you look at kids of color, Hispanics, African Americans, Native Americans, and if you actually raise the graduation rates and get them there by 2020, you will add $1.3 billion to your state economy. And finally, by increasing the graduation rates of male students who would typically be engaged in crime-related activities, you would save the state $77.7 million in reducing your crime cost.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Ray and guests. To Senator Salzman's question, which is a very delicate one, I think, about trying to be inclusive and where does that start stop, I guess I would just reflect for a minute on how Senator Torres-Ray and I worked on this bill. It became really clear to me, well, to begin with, I was really preoccupied with flood issues down the southeast, so I thank Senator Torres-Ray for taking the lead. But as we started to listen to testimony and hear from witnesses, and, you know, I started to really understand Senator Torres-Ray's passion on this issue and the fact that most of the achievement gap is focused on children of color, it became apparent to me that I needed to step aside and let Senator Torres-Ray take the lead. And I would just suggest that as a dynamic that we consider. We are partners, and I'm going to do everything I can to support Senator Torres-Ray and be there and understand and listen and be engaged and support this work. But it's also very clear to me that we really listen to the communities of color about what the solutions are. Because for a good number of years, the solutions have always come in a top-down style from traditionally white middle-class leadership. And here we have an opportunity to engage communities of color, people with different ethnic backgrounds and different understandings of their cultural experiences. And Senator Torres-Rae has really helped me understand cultural competence, that we do whatever we can to support their leadership in this matter. We are partners. But I also think of one scene that was pretty dramatic in my life, as far as kind of like a light bulb coming on, and that is from the movie Gandhi, when Ben Kingsley is having a conversation with his white friend, and they're working on Indian independence. And it comes to a point when he asks this man to stand down because they need to do this work themselves and they need to be supported as partners and become the leaders. So I would just suggest that that's worked really well between Senator Torres-Rae and I understand the issues, but she really needs to be the lead on this, and I'm going to do whatever I can to support her.
So just a response, Mr. Chair, just very briefly.
Senator Saltzman, very briefly.
Very briefly. I think that in terms of the plans, I think that's great, but we're talking about money too. And that means that we have to be partners, and that means that people have to understand why these strategies are so important.
Right.
And being at the table to hear and understand is very, very important, I believe, of all of us. So.
I'd agree with that. So.
Okay, please, testifiers, proceed. And welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Wigo and members of the Minnesota Senate Education Policy Committee. My name is Dr. Romaine Dalamont, Superintendent of Rochester Public Schools, and I am grateful to be here to share with you an overview of our efforts to close what we're calling the opportunity gap. We're not calling this achievement gap in Rochester, and the reason is because opportunity gap is a term that encompasses the entire spectrum of disparities that exists in our schools. For example, students who are suspended, we know they will have an achievement gap. If a youngster is expelled, we know that that student will have an achievement gap. However, we do have other gaps of opportunities that greatly impact the overall academic and life success of our students. These inequities include access to fine arts activities, school sports, and other academic and extracurricular experiences, as well as pre-K and everyday full-day kindergarten programs. Now, the title of my presentation is All Students Can Become Proficient. And I was told when I first went to Rochester that all the roads in Rochester were paved with goals and everyone drive their Mercedes-Benz. What I will do is share with you a realistic picture of what is taking place in Rochester. This slide is pivotal to understand the breadth and depth of the opportunity gap that exists in our schools. 22% of the students in Rochester are performing below proficiency. That is 3,630 of our overall population of 16,300 students. Note that the opportunity gap in Rochester does not only include minority students. In fact, nearly 60% of the students in Rochester's gap are white students. Rochester has a minority population of 27.4%, which is an increase by 15% just 10 years ago. Rochester is one of the school districts where we're fortunate and we are experiencing growth in our population. Having said that, it is important to note that our growth is from our youngsters who are on free and reduced lunch, our Asian population, Hispanics, and blacks. One of the things that we also experience is that while it is true More than 50% of our black and Hispanic students are not proficient in reading, compared to 19% of our white students. Nearly 70% of our black students are not proficient in math. 65% of our Hispanic students are not proficient in math. And 27% of our white students are not proficient in math. It is important to know that when we convert the percentages into numbers, we have roughly 250 Hispanic students who are not proficient in reading and math, 500 black students who are not proficient in reading, 600 black students who are not proficient in math, over 1,200 white students are not proficient in reading, and over 1,600 white students are not proficient in math. The numbers can be deceiving when all we look at is the percentages, but when we look at actual number of kids, and this goes back to the question that you asked earlier, Senator Salzman. The gap is everybody's problem and everybody's challenge. Both white minority students are in need for better education. In fact, when we look at school districts around the country where they are closing gaps, we learn that even those who are part of gifted and talented program improve in performance. We are developing a five-year strategic comprehensive plan to close the gap in Rochester. And we believe we have innovation. We are developing our own theory of action. And we are going to deploy the theory of action in three different tiers. Tier one, where we have seven schools. Those seven schools have 1,647 students who are part of the gap. Tier one, we are going to implement strategies, interventions in math and reading next year, as well as efficacy training for teachers and parents. We're going to focus on three major components: teaching and learning, access and equity, culture and diversity. Tier two will be for the year 2009 and 2010, and then we have a tier three. Our goal is to move all of our schools to what we call the goal range part of our metrics in 5 years, where all students will meet goal showing improvement. What are the consequences of inaction? Consequences of if we do nothing. In fact, let me also mention that what we also experience is that out of the 13,500 school districts we have in the nation, very few districts are successful when it comes to closing the gap. And all of those districts have a plan. All of those districts have a theory of action. And all of those districts sustain the plan and make sure that they follow through and have accountability in place. If we do nothing, this slide is very important from a 2000 survey that was conducted by Dr. Ron Ferguson, where Dr. Ferguson looked at percentages of 26 to 30-year-old black and white male that were dropouts. And the survey looked at whether those males were employed during the survey week, incarcerated, or employed the year prior to the survey. What Dr. Ferguson found is that less than 50% of the black male dropouts had worked in the year prior, and 26% of the black male dropouts were incarcerated. For black males that had a high school diploma, 66% of them were employed the prior year, and 11% of them were incarcerated. Finally, for black males that had a college degree, the odds were best, where the employment rate was higher, and only 1% of them were incarcerated. As you can see by looking at this survey, making sure that our students receive a high-quality education is an economic investment in our state. Investing in education means that we are less likely to need to invest in the criminal justice system, The bottom line is education is the number one crime prevention strategy that we have.
Thank you very much, Superintendent. Questions? Okay, Superintendent. And as I said earlier, we totally agree that there is a need to close the gap. And that's been reaffirmed in testimony. We're with you. And we'd like to focus on how the proposed legislation will help in achieving that, if we could, Superintendent.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Wieger and Senators. First of all, I believe that my two esteemed colleagues have given you really good data about the need. And I will just share with you that, surprisingly, since I represent a suburban school district, or what's labeled that, we have around 21,500 students. 40% are students of color, about 30% poverty, and 4,000 speak 80 languages. I share that with you only because it's always a surprise to people. But I will share with you that, like these two school districts, we do have a plan. And so I can really respect and appreciate your question. But we're here, I'm here, because I'd like to learn from other superintendents. I'd like to learn from other school districts, because I think there's pockets of excellence all over our district, but we're not looking at it from a systems approach. Each of us is trying to look at it from a systems approach. Our senator is trying to look at it from a state systems approach, and that's the reason that she's here and why she's invited us, because we want to make a bigger difference than just the students in our system. As our mission is to inspire and prepare all students with the courage, confidence, and competence to achieve their dreams, contribute to community, and engage in a lifetime of learning. We have a plan very similar in terms of how St. Paul's was described, but the two strategies that brings me to the table is, one, that we'll overcome all obstacles, and two, that we're going to leverage the assets of the system and community to optimize results. So I will tell you that if this proposal is approved, we'll submit our plan, and each of us will submit our plans. And then what we think is, through this advisory committee, a plan can be developed that will provide pieces and parts that all school districts in the state can not only access but learn more from each other. And our plan will include some state policies, with all due respect, that work against our being able to mitigate this problem. That's why I think that it's important for our senator to get involved and talk about a state plan, because right now we have policies that are in conflict of interest to make this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Questions?
As fast as I can.
Yes, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hintz, who is one of my superintendents, so I appreciate you being here. Do you think that this is important to have this as a distinct bill versus Senator Sossaman talked about the importance of moving every child forward? And I know we're going to be talking about legislation that has a different kind of testing, so that we can move towards a model where we're measuring progress of every student. And so I'm just wondering how we want to proceed as a policy committee. Do we want to have the achievement gap, which is so important to the success of our state and our economy, be this separate piece, or should it be within an overall mission to move every student in the state forward? What's your...
Senator Wieger and
Superintendent
Bonoff, thank you. Well, first of all, I totally support Senator Saltzman. In fact, I need to share with you that included in our plan is that every one of our teachers is in a professional learning community asking four questions. What are the standards? How do we know if the student is achieving them? What are we going to do if they're not? And what are we going to do if they already have them mastered? Because there is an achievement gap all the way from gifted and talented to certainly students that are really struggling. So my answer to your question directly is that I don't think it should be or. I think it should be and. I think we have to call out the achievement gap for students who aren't proficient through this kind of a bill, but I don't think it should be at the exclusion of all students achieving. And I heard Maria say her very first words were that we want to raise the levels of learning for all students. So I don't think it's not or, it's and.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Superintendent, I agree with you, and I think that, which is why I do support this bill, because I think it does put that laser-like focus on this critical problem, but I also do support the whole committee's effort to make certain that we have an umbrella bill as well.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, I want to make sure that I also respond to that, because I think this is the tension that sometimes, you know, we have in terms of defining what comes first, you know, mm-hmm. how do we do it best? What is the best approach? I think what I've learned through the years, particularly with respect to disparities in child welfare, which has been my career during the last 18 years, is that when it comes to disparities, you actually have to name it, and you actually have to put a plan in place to address that very issue.
Yes.
When we talk about child welfare disparities and disparities in health, it was not until we really started talking about the actual populations that face those particular problems that we began to incorporate some of the cultural competent practices and understanding the very problems that affect those particular populations. That is the reason I decided to really focus my attention in this area, because the practices that Senator Saltzman and that you are proposing in terms of early childhood education are going to be part of this, of course. But what needs to happen is that in terms of implementing those practices, we're going to have to better understand the background of those very children that face these challenges today. So if these children are children from immigrant communities, if these children live in impoverished communities, if these children are homeless, if these children come from a single-parent home, all of those components are issues that educators have to understand. And it is only then when we will be able to really move forward with policies that actually will impact their lives. So I'm hoping that we can move forward understanding that those things kind of need to be addressed in a kind of holistic way.
Good. Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray, I believe you have two additional testifiers, and then we have two others that wanted to address us. And
yes.
I'm hoping that
we can process this
before 5 o'clock. Otherwise, it'll go into the evening or at another date.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to invite Dr. Martha Bigelow from the University of Minnesota, and Mr. Rogelio Munoz, who is representing the Councils of Color.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Education Committee. My name is Martha Bigelow. I'm an associate professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. I'm in the Program of Second Languages and Cultures Education. I am very happy to be here to talk about this bill. I gave some feedback on the language of an earlier version, and I was so happy to see that a lot of my suggestions were integrated. So I'm very happy to be here to address some of the things that I see as strengths and maybe some things also to continue to think about. My particular area of expertise is in working with immigrant and refugee learners, and I prepare teachers to do that as well. I work in schools to that end, in public, alternative schools, charter schools, and my work with them focuses on curriculum development, assessment, teaching strategies, all manner of nuts and bolts. I'll speak to some of the aspects of the bill that I think are relate to English language learners, and I'm going to confine my comments to things that relate to my area of expertise, which is the English language learners. I think that this bill will do much to close the achievement gap. I like the components of it that urge districts to offer everyone more rigorous courses and higher expectations, but I think it's also really, really important to turn our gaze to the gap and to have this legislation focus directly on the gap. I think it allows us to focus on systems, on data, as well as capacity building needed to affect this incredible change of what this bill will mean for so many districts. We heard from some amazing superintendents today that are doing wonderful things, but I think that this bill will affect change in many, many ways in places that really need it. I think that this bill will encourage districts to hire and retain teachers who are bilingual, experienced in working with culturally and linguistically diverse youth. Bilingual. I think it will also allow for a system to train teachers. We're doing our end, we're trying to do as much as we can on our end at the U of M to prepare pre-service teachers to work with linguistically diverse students, but I think that this bill will also support work to help in-service teachers with this. I think it will urge districts to examine their program design for access, to look at their curriculum and their assessment practices for access, and to break down structural barriers to overcome a lot of these overarching issues as well as just the day-to-day things. There's a couple things that I'd like to urge you to think about a little bit, too. The role of the native language in newcomers and immigrant youth is essential. And there's some language in the current bill that might not include transitional programs that are bilingual or use the native language in some way. So I think that that would be something that might enhance the bill. I've also seen in my own experience the recent tendency for under-referral of English language learners and in our school districts to special education. And I think one of the main issues around this is a lot of myths about how long you need to wait to be able to assess English language learners. So that's one thing to maybe consider, because I think that the over-referral issue is probably very true for many of our minority students, but the under-referral issue maybe is what's the next step. Thank you. I look forward to answering any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you. Ms. Bigelow?
Yeah.
I'm trying to circle back to a question I asked earlier. My bias, which could be incorrect, is that most districts that need to be attacking this problem are, or at least trying to. They may have a plan. They may not have, you know, quite as much as St. Paul did. Do you have, in your experience, do you have examples of districts that are not taking a run at the achievement gap? Are there districts out there that are floundering and that need the state to come in? I mean, my bias is there's a lot of school boards and a lot of superintendents that are spending every day on this. Tell me I'm wrong.
Ms. Bigelow.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Senator Michelle, I think you are wrong. I think that there's a lot of districts that
won't
be
the first time I'm told that today.
I think that there's a lot of districts, and we've seen a lot of data today that suggests that while a lot of districts are working on this and are trying, I think that we haven't seen enough change. I'd love to tell some of my personal experiences in working with schools. I won't cite any particular districts, but I think that there are many ways that access is denied for English language learners. Again, I'll focus specifically on them. And I think it's because a lot of districts, not our metro area districts, but a lot of our districts are still new to working with a population that may have limited formal schooling and are non-native speakers of English and they're coming into our system. So it's no wonder that they're falling through the cracks. And they're doing so at an enormous rate. And I'm very worried about all of our students of color. But I feel that we really are failing our immigrant and refugee kids in lots of programmatic ways, as well as a lot of ways that have to do with what teachers know and can do with kids in their class that don't speak English fluently yet.
And so, Mr.
Senator Michelle.
So your hope, Ms. Bigelow would be that the process that goes into putting together this plan, particularly for some of these districts that you, given your experience, think need some help, that putting together this plan will kind of recharge their efforts and frankly force them to address some things that they may be new to them, new demographics, new languages. And so you're hoping that putting together this plan will kind of kickstart that.
Yeah, I think that this bill has much potential for doing that and asking administrators and districts to focus on learners that are walking out their doors and never coming back.
Senator Torres, right.
I just wanted to make a comment about this because I think this is very important. We had testimony, Senator Mitchell, for about 6 months asking the very question that you're asking. Do you have a plan? Could you tell us what you're doing and how you're doing and how do you measure? The answer is no. We have ideas. We're testing ideas. We're testing some practices. We're testing some measures. We're testing it with some groups. We're testing it with certain populations. We're testing, innovative practices. But to say that districts really have a plan in place, and I think St. Paul is a very unique case, and we will have to see really what their practices and their plan will show with time. We will have to see. But what we're trying to do really here is to look as a state responsibly for a set of best practices that all districts can use and measure, because I think that's one of the problems we have. One thing is to have a great idea and to go on with implementing that idea, but we will see if that idea actually becomes a practice that narrows or eliminates the gap, because that's the problem we have right now, that no one is able to tell us in very concrete ways that they implemented a practice and therefore they move into narrowing or eliminating the gap. We did not get an answer to that question.
Thank you. Members, we will recess in 15 minutes. I want to note that Senator Rummels has testifiers that will be back at 6, but we will take up her bill when we return, unless there's any other discussion. But there's at least three other people to testify in yours, Senator Torres Ray, and we can take as much time as you need, but only 15 more minutes for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll move quickly.
Mr. Chair, my name is Rogelio Munoz. I'm the Executive Director for the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Buenas tardes. Good afternoon. Today I represent a collaboration and united voice among the state councils of color, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, the Council on Black Minnesotans, the Indian Affairs Council, and the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. For the past 6 months, the state councils of color and the Indian Affairs Councils have continued to meet and discuss collaboration on public policy issues, one of those issues being education, the disparity on education between students of color and white students in the state of Minnesota. It is important to keep in mind, as you already know, and as most of the policymakers here already know, that Minnesota's population is becoming more diverse, whether through foreign immigration, natural population growth, secondary migration from other states. According to the Children's Defense Fund, there are currently 1.2 million children in the state of Minnesota. 12% of those children are immigrant children or students in our public schools. These communities represent Latin America, Southeast Asia, Eastern Africa. 2 years ago, the percentage of students of color in Minnesota public schools was at 20%, and that's broken down at African American students representing 8% of that cohort, Asian American students 5%, Latinos 5%, and American Indians at 2%. In that same year, 13% of all Minnesota high school graduates were students of color. That percentage translates to only 8,000 Minnesota high school students that were students of color. By 2015, students of color will comprise about 20% of Minnesota high school graduates. Largest increases are projected in the Black and Hispanic communities. Now, these two student populations historically have had low graduation rates and participation in institutions of higher learning. Now, we support this bill because it's a starting point in the right direction for the future of the state. The bill gives schools the opportunity to make an assessment and develop a plan to significantly improve the disparity of academic achievement. In that regard, it encourages schools to find those best practices statewide that target the achievement gap. Now, the councils' work, that's basically what, you know, councils of color are charged to do, is to work with communities of color and find out what issues are impacting our communities. This past summer, what we did at the Latino First Council is that we visited several communities throughout the state, and we visited with educators and superintendents. And in those discussions, we found that there is a significant achievement gap between students of color and white students. And there are very good practices going on throughout greater Minnesota. Austin Public Schools being one of those schools, Sleepy Eye Public Schools throughout this, throughout southern Minnesota. There's currently good practices, but they're not being highlighted at a state on a statewide stage, so that they can be incorporated into this plan that Senator Torres Rey is proposing. Now, with that same respect, the plan, as I said, as a starting point, it gives school districts an opportunity to have an assessment. You know, where are we with our students of color, and what is the disparity, what is the achievement gap between students of color and white students? With regards to funding, it's I believe it's line C, 1.20, how current resources are being used. I'm pretty sure that we all know the funding formula of how school districts receive funding. We have LEP, which is language, limited English proficiency, basic skills, integration funds, and compensatory funds. In that regard, what we have seen is we've seen an explosion of growth in rural Minnesota. We've seen Latinos, people from the Latino community, Southeast Asian community, Eastern African community, go into rural areas such as Wilmer, such as Worthington, St. Cloud, Moorhead, Rochester. We've seen this explosion of communities. These children are bringing resources to our school districts. However, we need to make sure that these school districts are accountable for how they appropriate these funds so that they can trigger and target the achievement gap and, Superintendent Dolleman said, the opportunity gap that is between students of color and white students. Now, I don't want to go in light of time, Mr. Chair. I just want to make reference to the bilingual and culturally competent teachers that we need to recruit. As I just recently said, by 2015, Minnesota students of color, 20% will graduate from our public schools. We need to really prepare and invest into this capital. If we don't, we might be potentially at a lost opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Munoz. Questions? Thank you. Concludes for the proponents at this point. We had some others, Teresa Grahams, and also from the Department of Education, Michelle Weber. First, Ms. Grahams. Thank you. And Dr. Karen Ephraim.
Thank you. My name is Teresa, that's T-E-R-E-S-A, middle initial M, and the last name is Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M. It's misspelled on your agenda. I want you to hear a few words from the real world today. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker and a licensed school social worker. I've worked for over 30 years, 16 of those years, with communities of color and children of color and children of poverty. So I think I speak with some authority on this issue. My concern about the achievement gap bill, which I would agree would be an opportunity gap bill, is not that it's not a good concept, but it's duplicative. I sent each of you an email today with a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor in November 2005 that indicated the Integration Revenue Program, which you folks passed about 8 years ago, has grown by leaps and bounds and currently is taking up almost $100 million of taxpayers' money, 70% state money and 30% local levy. The recommendations in that auditor's report from 3 years ago have not been addressed by the legislature, and so this is just going to add to the already huge problem. And some of those had to do with the clarifying the purpose of the integration program, revising the funding formula,
and having some kind of accountability for the outcomes in the program. Many of these are the same things you're talking about today. They're the same things, quite frankly, you've been talking about for the last 30 years. And the House had a work group this fall that talked extensively about the recommendations for the integration revenue program. And my suggestion would be simply to meld these two together and not add another layer onto what is already a huge problem. People are starting to notice $100 million sitting out there that is not properly accounted for is a lot of money when all the school districts are saying they don't have money to buy pencils and paper for children. So that's essentially what I wanted to say to you, and I hope you will review that legislative auditor's report and that this session will do something about those recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch. I planned my testimony based on the bill as it was introduced, not realizing about the delete all amendment. I have to say that the delete all amendment is better, but it still doesn't deal with the major problems. Basically, government intervention to close the achievement gap has not been successful. If you look at the quotes in the findings and the purpose section of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act on the federal level for at least three incidents that I can find under both Republican and Democratic Congresses and under Democratic and Republican administrations, they all say the achievement gap is still there. We haven't closed it yet. And No Child Left Behind is the most recent attempt, and it has given us adequate yearly progress mandates and all sorts of federal interference that this committee and the legislature have dealt with on numerous occasions. The things that are being discussed in the bill as it was introduced and even in the new bill haven't been effective and aren't effective. Besides No Child Left Behind, which the legislative auditor says that 80% to 100% of Minnesota districts will fail to achieve adequate yearly progress, which is the mechanism to close the achievement gap. There's a lot of talk about early childhood and all-day kindergarten programs, which by lots of different analyses have not found statistically significant long-term improvement in the majority of studies, be they large or small, model or big. And I have a table that summarizes the results for the committee. And numerous studies have shown that increased funding has no effect on educational achievement. So what I would say is that what we would recommend instead of more programs, more plans, more mandates from the legislature is instead to hear and pass Senator Hand's bill, Senator Michelle's bill, Senator Jungbauer, bill from last session that that pull Minnesota out of No Child Left Behind. They're identical to the bill that this committee passed unanimously several years ago and that the full Senate passed by a wide margin. Number two, don't spend effort and money on early childhood programs that have no academic or behavioral long-term benefit and do have evidence of academic and emotional harm. Use that money instead to focus on the things that actually have shown to close the achievement gap, such as William Jane's study from University of California at Santa Barbara, which showed that intact two-parent families and high religious affiliation close the achievement gap in a study of 20,000 Hispanic and African American youth. Okay. focus on those kinds of things. And also in policy, because single-parent families are a source, those children have the most not only educational but also social social problems.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Questions? Ms. Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Weber, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. And I'll keep my comments very brief. We want to thank Senator Torres Ray for her thoughtful approach to closing the achievement gap. And we've been in discussions with her, and we'll continue to work with her on the amendment that was introduced. Some of the things that we do have a concern with is analyzing the number of districts that this would impact. We would also like to see this linked to a current school improvement plan that's required. And we want to make sure that districts have enough time to put together a thoughtful and meaningful plan at the local level. And then with the task force that's been included in the amendment, we need some time to look at any funding implications that there might be as a part of that. Where the amendment is asking the task force to take on quite a bit of work, and so we'd like some time to take a look at that, and we'll continue to work with Senator Torres Ray on those issues.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify? Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate File 3151, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to state and local government. Further discussion? And Senator Torres Ray, again, thank you, Senator Erickson Ropes, for the subcommittee work, and the need is very compelling, convincing to put together a plan for the state. A lot of different plans have been shared, Rochester, St. Paul, Osseo, but this collective vision is needed. You've been very open to suggestions and ideas that have been reflected in your delete all amendment, and I know that it's your intent to continue to work with others interested in achieving the same goal. So with that understanding, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Before we recess, here's the plan. After caucus for each party, I believe it'll be about 6 o'clock or so that we'll be meeting in room 112. We will first take up Senator Rummel's bill, and it is our intent to process that. And if there is specific questions, concerns, committee members want to reflect to the author or want to be notified before we take action, please let us know. If there's a reasonable amount of time, then we will at least start discussion presentation on the Department of Education's omnibus bill. We are in recess. Yes, staff will bring your materials up to room 112.